From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
Well, both what was going on 100 years ago, but perhaps also some more some other perennial issues. I'm obviously interested in the whole question of how women use power, that is, how they gain it and then use it, mm-hmm. and how the men and women around them see their use of this power. And this, of course, is something that, as I said, Nightingale has been criticized for many years.
And what feminist philosophers are beginning to say is that the ways in which we've structured our world, the conceptual schemes and frameworks that we use to understand it, these have been developed by men, and that they reflect men's interests and men's values.
Welcome to Soundings, Literature, Philosophy, and Feminism. Those are the topics this week on Soundings. My guests are two recent visitors at the National Humanities Center, Martha Vicinas of the University of Michigan and Allison Jagger of the University of Cincinnati. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation about feminism and literature with Martha Vicinas. Following that, a discussion with Allison Jagger about feminism and philosophy. Martha Vicinas is currently at work on a forthcoming edition of The Letters of Florence Nightingale.
Well, I actually think that for most of us who've been active in the women's movement for 15 years, the whole canon debate is a little tedious simply because we've been talking about it for so long and pointing out the way in which the canon is male, white, traditional, mm-hmm. Reified, really, to fit previous needs, perhaps to fit the needs of the publishing world. You teach what's in print. And so the arguments perhaps are not as interesting for us. What is much more interesting is how one can integrate an interdisciplinary approach into one's own discipline. And I think mm-hmm. this is very hard, and perhaps becoming harder as there are more people publishing more things. So it's hard to keep up.
Well, if you could wave the magic wand, what steps would you take? How would you achieve this interdisciplinary goal that you're after? You mentioned publishing. What, putting more titles in front of students, things that aren't available to them now? Beyond that, what?
Well, I think also trying to do some more team teaching, trying to get faculty themselves to rethink their own discipline from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. Perhaps some of the most exciting experiments are going on in things like combining a composer, a mathematician, and a psychologist to team teach a course on numbers and thinking.
Educational holism.
That's right.
Okay.
And the same thing can be done over issues on women, where you might combine someone in literature history and, mm-hmm. say, biology or public health or mm-hmm. issues like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that that experience of teaching with somebody else who will look at the same problem from a really very different perspective can't help but affect one's own work, and mm-hmm. then you do start actually rethinking your discipline in exciting new ways. I think we get very set in how we look at a problem.
Women's studies, Martha? They're not monolithic, I take it. But do they have a goal? Is there some sort of, as you look over the horizon, you're trying to figure out exactly where you're going? Tease that one out for me.
Well, there are two main camps in the women's studies world. One is the assimilationist camp that believes that in the best of all possible worlds, by, say, the year 2050, women's studies will no longer be necessary because we will have a truly gender-free university. Mm-hmm. That camp, by and large, puts a good deal of energy into what is called mainstreaming, that is, getting women and women's issues into basic courses. I myself think this is very important, but I think one has to avoid the whole problem of add 1 week of women and stir, add 1 week of blacks, add 1 week of other minorities. Uh-huh. In other words, you're not truly integrating new perspectives.
Right.
It gets back to my original point about the need of actually rethinking the way we look at our discipline mm-hmm. instead of just adding.
Martha Vicinas, you come to the Humanities Center as a visitor from the University of Michigan. You teach in English and in women's studies. You are now working on a project, your focal point is Florence Nightingale. What have you got cooking? Why are you interested in her?
first What I Have Cooking is an edition of a selection of her letters. It's hard to believe that the perhaps the woman that next of Queen Victoria is the most famous Victorian woman, there is no selection of her letters in print. There are a number of biographies, but it seems to me a very obvious project to do a nice, handy one-volume selection. There are 14,000 letters, more or less, in 70 different libraries in 5 different continents. So this is something of a larger project than I had intended. I think it would be extremely difficult for one person to do a complete edition. But as a start, I think we need a workable edition to reintroduce Nightingale to us.
What did she write about? We have, what, a stereotypical version of her, a nurse in Victorian England. Help me with this, Tennyson and the Battle of the What, the Charge of the Light Brigade. All of that right?
Yes.
And beyond that, what might we know about her?
Well, Florence Nightingale is known as the founder of modern nursing and the savior of the Crimea. Mm-hmm. The Crimean War was the major war that occurred in the middle of the 19th century, 1854 to 1856, that the English fought between the Battle of Waterloo in 1815 and the opening of World War I in 1914. And the battle was attended by war correspondents from the London Times who were regularly wiring back reports on the inefficiency and bumbling qualities of these ancient generals. And the public opinion was so horrified by conditions, they discovered that the men and the seat of war were dying at a rate of 10 to 1 from disease and malnourishment and cold rather than from battle wounds, that there was a scandal that brought the government down. And Florence Nightingale, with a band of 40 nurses, was sent out to nurse the sick.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much the wounded, really, as the sick. And in 6 months, Nightingale transformed the mortality rate from 47% to 2%.
Mm-hmm.
And she did this largely, I have to say, through bypassing army bureaucracy. She had friends in high places, and the London Times opened a special fund called the Nightingale Fund. And so she had publicly donated money so she could buy food, she could buy clothing, and she could buy medicine.
When did all of this happen in her life, Martha?
She was her early 30s.
Did she peak early, and do we associate correctly the stereotype of the nurse with her for the rest of her life? Again, what's going on in these letters? What are you looking at from a scholarly standpoint that we may not know anything about?
Well, she certainly has gone down to us in history as the lady with a lamp, and there is an enormous amount of literature about the woman who saved the soldier, and her unfailing goodness, selflessness, sacrificing her brilliant career as a center of the aristocracy of London.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality, of course, is far, far different. She was in her early 30s when she went to the Crimea. She was 90 when she died, and she returned and spent the ensuing 60 years working behind the scenes as a one-woman lobbyist for an incredibly wide range of issues. She was interested in, first of all, for obvious reasons, the reform of the army. She wanted to see the army professionalized and modernized. And that was her major achievement. Then she also, by extrapolation, became interested in India because the death rate of soldiers in India, the British soldiers, was very high. So she helped to lay the foundations for the sewage and water supply system of India.
An enormously influential person in ways that we don't normally think of her.
That's right.
Would you call her a feminist? Are you making her a feminist?
I would actually call her an anti-feminist, which is perhaps one of the reasons why I'm attracted to her.
Uh-huh.
She's a very powerful woman who would perhaps be known nowadays as our queen bee.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. What do you make of it? Are you going to criticize her for that? Or how, as it were, do you bring her into the 1980s? Or do you? Are you content, just to leave her back there in her own time?
Well, let me shift your question around, Wayne.
Sure.
I first became interested in Florence Nightingale because she's known as the founder of modern nursing and walks around really with a halo, I think, in nursing school circles, whereas among historians, She has never recovered from Lytton Strachey's attack upon her at the early years of the 20th century, where she's really seen as having clay feet, with clay that extends pretty far up.
Now, what did Strachey say about her? Some mean things, I take it, but what?
Strachey says that she was a power monger.
Oh, goodness.
And that she was highly manipulative and bullied men in high places.
Uh-huh. Sounds like jealousy, am I right?
Well, it sounds to me like he was uncomfortable with women who have power.
Uh-huh.
And she used power the only way she could. She could not sit in Parliament. She could not sit on parliamentary committees.
Mm-hmm.
She could not vote. She could only use power indirectly.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a past mistress at that.
All right. How, for example, might these letters, Martha Vicenus, you're looking at Florence Nightingale's letters, how might they open up some windows into the Victorian world? That what kind of a spin do you put on this in your notes or your interpretations of these letters? Are they going to help us to understand what was going on 100 years ago in England? What?
Well, both what was going on 100 years ago, but perhaps also some more some other perennial issues. I'm obviously interested in the whole question of how women use power, that is, how they gain it and then use it, and how the men and women around them see their use of this power. And this, of course, is something that, as I said, Nightingale has been criticized for many years. But the other thing that interests me is she had a very troubled relationship with her family. She was in her early 30s when she went to the Crimea, so she had had many years of performing the role of the dutiful daughter, making the rounds for the London season, and trying to get married by her mother. Her mother was very anxious that she married. And at the same time, she was very anxious that she follow her vocation. She felt God had called her to be a nurse. So some of the most poignant and interesting letters are those that she writes both to her mother and to a sympathetic aunt, the whole troubled relationship with her mother and her sister, and then her father and the role her father plays in intervening to help her fulfill herself. So, like so many of us, her letters are most interesting when she's not famous.
Martha Vicenus, you come to the Humanities Center from the University of Michigan. You are editing the letters of Florence Nightingale. Let's conclude our conversation, and let me be a little whimsical. Suppose Florence Nightingale sat right across the table, right here in front of a third microphone that we're not using. What would you say to her? What kind of a question would you put to her? Would you ask about her professional life, her personal life? What would you try to get at that you think that you're curious about and that you would want to take to a general audience about your subject?
I think the first question I would ask her is, why didn't you work with women instead of commanding other women? That she never really felt that any woman was her equal. She had a few men that she thought were her equals. I have to say, probably it's fortunate for her they all died young, so that she could create an ideal in her mind about them and not have to worry about competing with them. But she never had any woman she looked upon as an equal. And I would like to ask her that. She was smarter than almost anybody else, so perhaps that's why she was not modest.
Martha Vicenus teaches at the University of Michigan. Her books include Suffer and Be Still, Women in the Victorian Age, and Independent Women, Work and Community for Single Women, 1850 through 1920. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Literature, Philosophy, and Feminism continues now with a conversation featuring another recent visitor at the National Humanities Center. Allison Jagger is a professor at the University of Cincinnati. Her books include Feminist Politics and Human Nature and Gender, Body, and Knowledge. Allison Jagger, you come to the Humanities Center as a visitor from the University of Cincinnati. You are a philosopher and a feminist. Does one necessarily come before the other? Should I reverse the order of feminist and philosopher? How do you figure that mix out?
That's a good question. And it's even hard to say which came first in my own history. Certainly, I was consciously a philosopher before I was consciously a feminist. On the other hand, I think that in some ways, everybody's a philosopher to the extent that we all have our own worldview, sets of values, and so on. And I also think that on some level, even if not a conscious level, all women at least are feminists. Mm-hmm. They're not always willing to accept that label, but I kind of think, scratch any woman and you'll find a feminist. Mm-hmm. And so on a very, in a broad sense, a non-technical sense, I think that being a feminist and being a philosopher, if not in an academic way, is probably what everybody, all women are. Mm-hmm. They all have sets of values, worldviews, and so on. We all do, even if these aren't all that well consciously reflected on and worked out.
Well, let's tie that back to women's studies. You, mm-hmm. Before our taping session for Soundings, you said you wanted to talk briefly about that. Is there a necessary connection here among and between feminism, philosophy, and women's studies in the academic curricula these days?
Well, I thought it made sense to talk about women's studies first because it sets a kind of historical and political context for feminist philosophy. I guess I'm proud of the fact that, so far as I know, I taught the first course in feminist philosophy in the United States back at Miami University in Ohio in 1970. And at that time, what people thought of, or what people would say, what is feminist philosophy? And at that time, I think we thought of it as concerned with a set of issues regarding people's practical, social, and political lives. So I think at one time we thought of feminist philosophy as very much what's sometimes called applied philosophy, mm-hmm. public policy issues, concrete moral problems, and so on. And so the emergence of feminist philosophy happened at a time in the late 60s when the word relevance was just a tremendous buzzword. Everybody was trying to make their curricula relevant, and philosophers were trying to do it too. Uh-huh. And they had, after the Second World War, social, political, and moral philosophy were pretty much pronounced dead. They just didn't happen anymore for a variety of reasons, which I won't go into. In the late 60s, there was a revival of interest in social, political, and just moral, general normative issues. And philosophers, even if not feminists, started to concern themselves with issues around the Indochina War, for instance, civil disobedience, mm-hmm. questions of the just war, capital punishment, those kinds of issues. And so when feminists came in, we started with fairly well-defined issues. And they were, at the time, I mean, right now they don't seem very, I don't know, they seem a bit worn, threadbare issues to me now. But at the time, it seemed very innovative for philosophy to be discussing these practical questions. And I'd just like to give you a couple examples. The things that I have in mind are questions like the abortion issue, mm-hmm. preferential treatment, equality of the sexes, mm-hmm. prostitution, that kind of thing. Yes.
Are those still the sorts of issues that you are interested in as a feminist philosopher today? You say that some of these issues have become a bit thin and worn out. Where does feminist philosophy find itself in the late 1980s?
Well, what's exciting about the direction that feminist philosophy has taken is that it's come to challenge perhaps even some of the most central tenets and basic assumptions of the Western tradition. Let me try and explain what I mean by that. These issues like abortion and prostitution and preferential treatment and so on, we struggled with them. But the existing conceptual tools at our disposal didn't seem adequate for handling those issues.
Now, when you say a conceptual tool, Alison Jagger, just very briefly tell me what you mean by that. A method of doing philosophy?
For instance, the kinds of moral theories that were available did not seem to handle very well some of the issues that feminists were concerned with. For instance, the issue of abortion, if you try to handle that in a sort of natural rights framework, natural rights being a very common, a very popular philosophical theory, it transforms the fetus woman situation into an adversarial situation, which from a woman's point of view is not the most useful way of looking at it. It seemed like a new framework other than the, you know, conflict of rights framework would be more useful. And so with a variety of other issues as well. To begin with, the moral and political theories that were available did not seem adequate for handling the questions that we were concerned with. And so what we've come to do is to look more critically, first at the moral and political theories that were available, and then later at the underlying theories of human nature. My own book is called Feminist Politics and Human Nature, and it talks about the ways in which conceptions of human nature that have been dominant, you know, for the last several hundred years, in fact, are what feminists call androcentric, male-centered, and biased against women. So we began to look at theories of human nature. That was my own particular project. And later, to look at theories of knowledge, and just some of the most, the whole, let me say this, philosophy is not directly concerned with facts. As philosophers, we don't go out there and collect in a bunch of facts. What we're concerned with is concepts, with ways of looking at and structuring reality, ways of understanding facts. And what feminist philosophers are beginning to say is that the ways in which we've structured our world, the conceptual schemes and frameworks that we use to understand it, these have been developed by men, and that they reflect men's interests and men's values, and that they distort, they obscure women's contributions and distort the nature of what women are like. Now, what we claim, what I would claim, and many feminists, I mean, I should say, of course, that philosophers tend to be the most argumentative kind of people, and it's very difficult to
that's how you make your living
to have us be, of course it is, to be a monolithic group. There are many, many strands within feminist philosophy. We'd be the last group to have an orthodoxy or a line. But I think what we share is the belief that the Western tradition, which is the one that we're most familiar with, is in many ways male-biased, male-biased at its core, in its deepest concepts. We're particularly concerned with the way that conceptual dichotomies have been set up, oppositions like public and private worlds, gender dichotomies, I should say, in which each time one aspect or one pole of the pair is associated with masculinity and one with femininity. So masculinity is associated with the public, femininity with the private, masculinity with reason, femininity with emotion, the masculinity with the general, femininity with the particular, masculinity with the universal, the abstract, femininity with the concrete, those kinds of dichotomies. We argue that these dichotomies are not just pairs, separate but equal, but that they're hierarchical. Well, that they're pairs in which one pole, the one associated with masculinity, mm-hmm. gets preference, is higher than the other. Mm-hmm. Our goal is not to flip the coin, to set emotion above reason, or right. the private above the public. Mm-hmm. It's more to question the very structuring of reality in terms of those pairs and oppositions, to try and transcend those dichotomies, to find a new way of thinking about knowledge and reality and so mm-hmm. on.
Alison Jagger, let me ask you to be very specific and concrete. What contribution, maybe I'm asking you to speculate here more than give me an answer, what contribution might feminist philosophy make to the quality of our lives? Remember, you're speaking to a general audience here, people who are not specialists in philosophy. Do you worry about that kind of thing? Is that one of your concerns?
My belief is that philosophy can contribute to everybody's life, that everybody ought to have that time to work out their own philosophy. I wish there were more of it. Just the self-reflection in a systematic way and reflection on the social world that we live in. Mm-hmm. These are tremendously valuable to give us a sense of our own identity, a sense of our embeddedness in history and so on. Now, what feminist philosophy can do is to give us the benefit of feminist insights, which mm-hmm. in my opinion are, some people claim that penetrating is a masculine term, but I feel free to use it, which, or perhaps I'd want to say something like open up. Feminist philosophy can open up, reveal some of the, what I consider mystifications and mm-hmm. distortions of the Western tradition. I don't mean that we want to throw it out wholesale. I think we want it. The Western tradition is not a single sort of set of beliefs that can be summed up in a creed or something like that. There are mm-hmm. many strands within it. I think feminism can help us choose the most useful of those strands mm-hmm. And help us to reject some of what's been deleterious to human life and particularly women's lives.
Alison Jagger is a professor of philosophy at the University of Cincinnati. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Literature, Philosophy, and Feminism, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about history, political economy, and the American Constitution. My guest will be Stephen Conrad of Indiana University. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for conversations about literature, philosophy, and feminism. Wayne's guests are scholars from the University of Michigan and the University of Cincinnati. Feminists today address not only literary and philosophical methods and content, but also seek a reconsideration of literature and philosophy as influenced primarily by masculine values. Literature, Philosophy, and Feminism. Some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.